So Judy, just backing up and going to the 10,000 foot view here, even before the situation of deciding about landing, was this a flawed plan to begin with, or was it fairly reasonable in your opinion? Because you have the most experience with Catalina of anyone at this table.
I feel that it was a fairly reasonable idea to take off because all of the rest of SoCal was clear. If the rest of SoCal had been fogged in, it probably would not have been a very good idea. And my experience has been with the fog, particularly over Catalina summertime, is, you know, in the morning, maybe have a little bit of fog, and then it burns off. And having some passengers in the airplane and flying over the top of LAX airport is always kind of exciting. You know, you get to look down and see all those big jets down there taking off and landing. And, you know, so it would be just a nice time to fly around and just do some sightseeing flight, regardless if we landed at Catalina or not.
Yeah, I agree with Judy there. Just taking off, you got plenty of gas, you got plenty of options. It's a great day to fly. Go out there and have a look-see and see what it really looks like. I think I would be inclined to land and have a look. Now, my only concern would be get stuck there if the fog envelops over the runway. So I'm with you on that, but for the rest of it, I think, you know, that 200 feet of fog at the end of the runway doesn't bother me that bad. I've landed there once in the Mooney and pulled off at half field. I think I'm comfortable with the other elements there, so I might be inclined to have a land and look around, but be very careful that I don't get stuck there.
Well, now, if you land, Gigi brought up a great point of this no intersection takeoff that's in the chart supplement. If you read through the notes and happen to notice that, let's suppose you did land, you're now on Catalina, there's fog on the first 200 feet of the runway, and now you got to leave. How are you going to, how do you handle that? Is that something, I didn't actually read that. Or is that not an intersection takeoff because I'm going to back taxi to the fog, I'm not going to call that intersection? How would someone handle that?
And how thick is this fog? I mean, is it pea soup impenetrable, can't see your hand in front of your face fog, or is it a wispy cloud that you can see through and begin your takeoff roll in it? I don't know. When I look at this scenario, it's like I applaud Judy's thinking through the departure before landing, because that is key. But Judy, if the day were warming up, the temperature dew point is widening, this fog is gonna be gone in an hour. Would that change your calculus?
It most certainly would. And also at Catalina Island, you can take a bus down to town, and they have motels. So you always have the option of spending the night or spending more time there.
I want to go back to the question about the intersection takeoff, because maybe I'm drawing too fine a line here, but is it truly an intersection takeoff if there's no intersecting taxiway? If you just taxi down 200 feet from the approach in because it's the smart thing to do, do I have to consider that an intersection takeoff and illegal? I don't think so.
And that was the nature of my question. Where do people stand on that?
It's not a legal issue anyway. That's just an advisory issue on the no intersection, right?
Yeah, if it's in the chart supplement, I mean, is that... that's all advisory material, you're saying?
Yeah, and this airplane, especially if you're going downhill, runway length is not going to be a factor. And I look at and same with the landing. You know, I wonder, backcountry pilots are familiar with the idea of an abort point. And I just say, all right, if I'm configured on speed, 1 mile final, you know, ready to land, I'll consider that passing my abort point. And from that moment on, I'm committed to land. And that's not a... that doesn't seem like an unreasonable approach to the idea of landing on this runway. And also, you know, we do land and hold short operations all the time where displaced thresholds that could shorten the runway by hundreds of feet. And, you know, that's not a big deal. Also, you know, we make a big deal out of the fact that this Mooney tends to float in ground effect if you're fast, but to me, a highly wing-loaded airplane like a Mooney is an advantage in a precision landing, because you can, you know, if you're on speed, you can touch down right where you intend to. So, you know, for all these reasons would sort of mitigate toward landing not being an unreasonable thing to do.
I would make two points here about this. If I understand the scenario right, the pilot is inexperienced in general and inexperienced in this airplane. And Moonies are famous for landing too fast and the crow hop and, you know, where it goes from there. But in another segment, we talked about the slippery slope of judgment. Well, this, to me, is more like a kind of a terrace judgment. And I would make 2 points on it. One is that I would make a different judgment if I had passengers or if I was by myself. So by myself, I would land it. Second, this scenario is just a perfect argument for having an instrument rating, because if you have an instrument rating, you now have options, and that removes some of the tension of dealing with this kind of weather. And last, there is nobility in canceling, because if you look at a situation, you're not comfortable with it, and you prove to yourself that you can say no, you've upped your experience level, because now you know you've looked at a set of circumstances and this doesn't feel right to me. I don't think I can do this. I'm going to say no. And that adds to the experience bank.
And to both Judy and Paul's points, we should try to create an expectation with our passengers. And an expectation here might be is we're going to fly over LAX, we're going to fly out and fly around Catalina, and if that fog is in fact cleared, then we're going to land and look around. But the purpose of the flight here is to do the aerial sightseeing, not the sightseeing on the ground. And if you create an expectation in the pilots, then they're less likely to pressure you, and you're less likely to feel like you're being pressured just because they're in the airplane.
You know, I agree that flying around Catalina and going over LAX sounds like a really great way to spend a morning, and I would love to go along on that flight. But to Paul's point about the experience level and saying no builds the experience level, I'd also throw out that overcoming some obstacles improves your experience level too. And seeing a situation that is imperfect and coming up with a reasonable strategy of dealing with it and then successfully dealing with it, that's experience too.
So let's take that contrast, because I hear both of those really well. Like you need to work outside your comfort zone, but inside your zone of capability in order to build yourself as a pilot. And you may be crossing too close to the end of your zone of ability without realizing it and go past it and end up with a bad situation. If you are walking someone through this, And saying, okay, you've decided you're going to make this landing. Dave, you talked about having, you know, an abort point of being on numbers, but things can go wrong well past that. So where else and how else does a pilot sort of trap those errors? How do they set a situation where if they're floating, at what point do they give up on this? If it's a go around and there's fog at the end that you might be going through, how are you going to handle that go around?
I'm not going to do a go-around. I'm committed to land once I pass my abort point. That's pretty straightforward. Also, you know, Paul's point about a pilot behaves differently when he's solo than with passengers. I mean, that is so true. And I am the most conservative pilot there ever was when I'm flying with my family or friends. And I wish I could say that I was that way. I wish I could say that I didn't take additional risks when solo. If I'm being honest, I do push it more when I'm solo. I'm working on that. It's a flaw. I'm trying to improve. But it's interesting to Paul looks at this and says, I would land if I was solo. I wouldn't land if I had passengers.
Yeah, I agree with that, Dave. I would just say I don't think you need to fix anything there. I think you should take more risk when you're solo, like you said you do. That's the time to push your comfort zone a little bit. And I fly differently when I have passengers. I also find that when I have my family on board, that's a little more tense to me. I feel a little more sort of pressure and anxiety flying passengers than I do on an FAA check ride when I have my family on board. So there's just a lot of dynamics that you're thinking of. You want them to enjoy the flight and be comfortable, and you're nervous that they're not and so forth. But going back to the question about, you know, at what point do you abort? I'm with Dave in that, or if you commit to, all right, I'm going to just land. I think this will be fine. But here are some sort of tripwires that I'm looking for. I've got to be on speed. And if I'm not on speed when I get to within 300 feet of the runway or something, okay, that's the point I'm going to go around. So I would establish those little sort of, you know, tripwires or breakpoints, if you will, before I go all the way in and land.
I agree about the abort point. And I think, you know, I've always taught that there's a 100-foot window off the end of the runway, and that's the abort point, because typically on short runways, people abort too late. So once you commit to the landing, I think you need to go ahead with it. One of the interesting things here is that the end of the runway is not visible. Having shot a lot of low visibility approaches, we all know the instrument runways are very closely marked as to where you are. And I would question, given the pilot's experience, how aware he would be of where he is on the runway, which is critical in this event.
And also, I think it's important to distinguish between an abort and a go-around. So a go-around is if you're 300 feet elevation above the runway and you don't like the looks of it because of speed and calculated touchdown point, you go around. But once you've touched down and you're going to abort, that's a whole nother set of considerations. And I agree, in any airplane, but especially in a Mooney, now you have a difficult decision to go around basically a touch and go, or to try to stop the thing. And so many pilots try to stop the thing and end up in a heap at the end of the runway.
Well, and that goes to the point of in this situation, if you attempted to abort and take off again, you may be temporarily even IMC on the go. And that goes back to your point of having at least that basic instrument training and thinking through what that abort is actually going to be.
Well, on our practical tests, even at the private pilot level, we're required to touch down within a certain distance, 400 feet. And most runways with standard markings have a runway stripe that is about 120 feet long. The space between them is about 80 feet. So the combination of a runway stripe and a space is 200 feet. That's how we should judge ourselves on a landing like this. We're going to touch down on this stripe or that stripe. And if we're not going to touch down on one of these first two stripes, we go around. So it's real easy when you think about it, coming down final approach, to judge where you're going to touch down and whether you should abort the landing attempt.
Just a couple things, you know, with the discussion that have come to mind. One is at Catalina Airport, they do have markers. So this pilot's been there before, and the markers tell you how much available runway is left, you know, like you were at an airport that has a control tower. So you do have that off to the right side when you're landing on runway 22. But the other point I wanted to make is I think that the pilot needs to have the confidence that they can do this. And one of the things that I teach, and I think it's real important, is I tell my students, if they're not sure about something, if they're guessing or, you know, trying to make a decision about their ability, if they should or shouldn't do it, they shouldn't do it. Because I think that they need to have the confidence they can do this. And if they're not sure about it, then they shouldn't do it. Perhaps maybe they need to, you know, go with a flight instructor to gain some confidence.
Yeah, and that makes sense. That goes back as well to what people were saying earlier about what you would do alone or what you would do with other people. And I really liked Richard's point about just having other people in the airplane raises your anxiety level to a certain degree, and that impairs your ability to focus on what's going on.
But, you know, you bring up confidence, and in my mind, this pilot ought to be feeling pretty darn confident, because this pilot is current in this airplane, has been to this location before, has landed this airplane successfully and got off at midfield at this exact location. And that pilot's proficiency and currency, to me, means a lot more than the fact that they're relatively inexperienced in total flight time. Total flight time is a terrible measure of pilot competence. And this person, to me, you know, when just looking at them on paper, that pilot is current and proficient and well-trained in their aircraft.
This scenario also brings up some interesting just sort of legal minutia questions that come up. I mean, you were talking about, Jitty, how in class golf airspace, down low, uncontrolled airspace, it's 1 mile visibility clear of clouds. Is landing towards a fog bank that's now less than a mile away as you're going to touch down, is that a visibility of less than 1 mile, right? Is this landing potentially a violation just in that count? There's this sort of oddness that can happen in here. Any thoughts on that? Same thing about we had with the intersection departure, you know, is it an intersection departure or not?
I don't think so, because if you look to the left, the visibility is more than a mile, so just don't look straight ahead.
And not to get too Clintonian with my word parsing here, but it's like when this airplane touches down, it is a ground vehicle. It is not flying. So it's like the fact that it's within less than a mile from the clouds. It's like, fine, I'm not flying. I'm a ground vehicle.
Going back to the intersection departure, looking at the airport, I think the reason that's there because probably the intersection is not visible from the end of the runway. That would not apply in this instance because nobody's going to be at the end of the runway.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's probably what it is. And that's, you know, it's hard to, how do you parse these kind of notes and figure them into your flying? I think we've said that, you know, the thing that you're going to measure everything against is sort of a reasonable level of safety. And, you know, does this make sense? Does this not make sense? Let's talk a little bit about the, you know, committing to takeoffs too. This pilot, you brought something up interesting, Judy, about taking off downhill. It's a bizarre feeling. And you end up in a situation, especially something low slung like the Mooney, where you could get that plane off into ground effect well below its flying speed and then go off the end of the runway and suddenly have ground effect drop 1,200 feet below you. You know, how does a pilot who hasn't had a kind of a lot of experience in these situations, or this is a really odd situation, how do you prepare yourself for that?
Well, I think the other thing too is you fall back on your training. You know, anytime you've been in a situation where there's a lot of pressure, whether it's high school and you're on the foul line to make a shot or whatever it is, you think through and you weigh out that pressure by just focusing on your technique. And so that's what I would recommend is at the end of the runway, you go, okay, this is going to be a little bit odd, but I'll just focus on my technique. You know, I know when I rotate, I know when this plane comes off the ground, and that's what I'll focus on.
Makes sense. And that's also that whole idea of flying the numbers, you know, that you're, you know, not letting yourself get suckered in by the visual illusion of what's going on by watching what's actually happening on the airplane.
The one thing that I just realized the scenario doesn't talk about is had the pilot taken off downhill on runway 4 when they went out there the 3 previous times. So possibly the pilot had taken off on runway 4 with an instructor and is comfortable with it. So I think that's another factor here. Have they done that?
You know, Judy, you bring up a good point in that if they hadn't, it would have been a good idea to, and that is to try to get, and we've all talked about it here, you know, a lot of hours isn't necessarily a good judge of a pilot's experience. It's when you go into some place like that, take the opposite takeoff just to see it one time, because whenever you go in the next time and you have to do it, you've already practiced it one time.
Right, and I think that's probably a good takeaway from this whole scenario is that, you know, doing these things that are at the edge of your comfort zone, first with a more experienced pilot who maybe has been to Catalina or at least an instructor and had some experience with that specific situation, then being able to do it on your own, then being able to do it with friends and family, because you are going to run into situations where something is completely unexpected, like last 200 feet of the runway isn't available, you know, stuff like that happens. And some of the things that come up are just going to be red herrings, as we said here, where, you know, it doesn't matter what the ASOS says, you can still do this. It really falls back on your shoulders. It's not a visibility issue. It's a pilot skill, ability, and risk management issue. And that's what you really need to be prepared for with the tools you have available.